This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events.
There is no doubt, and you'll hear no nostalgia for the Cold War from me, but there's no doubt that chaos has replaced communism in today's world. But we do have to, I think, take the view that we're going to see these problems for some time, and we have to get our international institutions and indeed our national governments working together to build some consensus.
When should the international community intervene in civil conflicts? That's the question we'll address on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Of the 36 wars currently being fought around the world, nearly all are civil wars. A civil war is defined as a conflict between factions or regions of the same country. And with us today to discuss how outside countries should respond to the increasing civil strife in the world are Rick Interfert, the U.S. Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations, Francis Deng, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the former Sudanese Minister for Foreign Affairs, and Ian Martin, the former Secretary General of Amnesty International, now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Rick Interfert says the United Nations has a very full plate with the current level of civil conflict in the world.
We have been talking here about the numbers of UN peacekeeping operations, of which there are now 17 in the world, which is a major increase over just a few years ago. And if you look at the most recent Security Council calendar, you see during the month, you see Angola, Somalia, Mozambique, Haiti, Chad, Libya, Macedonia, Cyprus, Iraq, Rwanda, Georgia, Tajikistan, Liberia, Western Sahara. So the numbers of nations that are coming to the UN to air their problems, grievances, and disputes are going up dramatically.
And do you see the increase in the number of conflicts in the world as a result of the end of the Cold War? Francis Deng?
What we have heard here are those situations where the countries themselves came to the United Nations seeking help with peacekeeping forces. But there are many countries where there are internal conflicts and where they are not agreed on any peace model or peace settlement that can then be kept by the United Nations. And those, to me, are even more serious because these are not attended to. As for the causes, there's no question that the world was structured bipolar, that the Cold War structures, I suppose, were helping countries maintain internal order. And I think governments were sufficiently reinforced to be strong enough to maintain order, even if that order was not equitable or just. Now, with the removal of those controls, I think the governments are weakened, and some of them are beginning to confront assertiveness of the type that they can no longer contain.
Ian Martin.
Yes, I agree with that. I think during the Cold War, one or other of the superpowers had an interest in propping up a regime, even if it was an authoritarian regime, maintaining some kind of internal stability. That interest ended with the end of the Cold War. That means that during the Cold War, the human rights violations that we saw around the world were very often the human rights violations carried out by authoritarian governments, whereas today there are much more human rights violations that occur when the state is extremely weak or has actually collapsed and are the consequences of internal armed conflict. And that's much harder to deal with by the traditional means of bringing pressure to bear on governments, because very often those governments don't any longer control the situation in their own territory. And that leads you on to the question of whether the United Nations or other international organizations can intervene effectively on the ground.
If I could just add to that, there is no doubt, and you'll hear no nostalgia for the Cold War from me, but there's no doubt that chaos has replaced communism in today's world. One question that I have is whether or not we are going through a transitional period. now that so many of these ethnic and other conflicts have arisen, many of which were suppressed by the strictures of the old order, whether or not we will see this as a continuing part of the world that we will live into the next century, or whether or not we will see these kinds of eruptions of disputes, whether or not we will be able to deal with them in some fashion through the international community, and whether or not we'll settle down. And I don't know the answer to that. But we do have to, I think, take the view that we're going to see these problems for some time, and we have to get our international institutions and indeed our national governments working together to build some consensus so that we can tackle these problems collectively.
Right. As a matter of fact, I should say that if our analysis is correct...
This is Francis Deng of the Brookings Institution.
Then the problems we see in the world today in many of those countries where there were repressions, in a sense, are symptomatic of some improvement in the sense that people are demanding their democratic freedoms, their respect for human rights. And so the crisis has a positive side, and that is that there's a quest for addressing some of the ills of the past. If that is the case, then I entirely agree with Rick also that we have to get together if there's a common interest in trying to resolve these problems so that those countries can move forward. Then there ought to be a vested interest on the part of those governments and the peoples of those countries working with the international community to rethink the arrangements that have not worked and to try to find new principles and institutional ways of governing those countries.
In the past, I think when there were internal conflicts, the issue of sovereignty would come up, and there was a reluctance to intervene in what might have been considered the internal affair of a sovereign country. But are we seeing more willingness on the part of the international community to intervene these days? Ian Martin, you were at the UN OAS mission in Haiti in 1993.
Well, first, for a long time, it's been accepted that human rights violations are a matter of legitimate international concern, not something that can simply be brushed aside as a matter of internal affairs. The difference comes when the international community actually intervenes on the ground or by some form of sanction, not merely examination of a country's human rights record and condemnation, but actually says we've got to go in there, perhaps monitor the situation on the ground, as the mission that I was involved with was doing in Haiti during last year and is doing again now. But that maybe go beyond that and not merely monitor the situation and try to dissuade human rights violations, but actually have a mandate physically to prevent them. The dilemma that's facing the international community today in the case of Rwanda, and which it has been desperately, desperately slow to address.
But it is, at least on the surface, it appears that it is much more difficult for a country to intervene within an internal or civil conflict than, say, an international or cross-border conflict, isn't it?
That's true. If you look at the Gulf War, where Iraq was a clear aggressor, I think it was easier in many ways to mobilize a coalition of nations to deal with that than it is when something is seen as a more internal matter. But take Rwanda as an example. Clearly we're seeing international human rights violations. Standards are being violated there. We're also seeing the potential of that conflict spilling over the borders. We are very concerned about what will happen in Burundi because of what's happening in Rwanda now. Also, you have the whole issue of refugees, of the humanitarian costs of what's taking place. So even though something may be happening within the borders of one country, these things often have international or regional consequences for peace and security. And I think it's in that case, in those cases, that you see a greater willingness among nations to step in.
Francis,
can I just add to that? I think the examples that Rick gave are, in fact, easier because we have a situation where a state has collapsed and there's no government that is really responsible. But I think you could push the argument even further to cases that are more difficult and yet quite challenging. And that is where sovereignty is seen not just as an abstract notion, but one that has responsibilities for the citizens. Mm-hmm. And if a large portion of the country, the citizens of the country, are affected, with the result that you have mass starvation and maybe death, then the question is that government in a position to plead sovereignty, to keep the world out of it, or is the world entitled to come in and do something about it? It then becomes a question of what obligation is there on the world, on the international community, or the United Nations? Is there a duty to intervene, or is this just simply a humanitarian response?
Well, Rick Innerford, I wanted to ask you about what about a situation where the rulers of a sovereign country are being challenged by a large part of their population? Does that give the international community some different guidelines?
Well, I think Francis is, as to use expression, pushing the envelope a bit in terms of how far the international community is willing to go. I think if you look at this in terms of a neighborhood and somebody's house, if it is a purely domestic squabble, that's one thing. If you start seeing people leaving and going into the neighborhood, that's another. Or if those people try to take somebody else's house, there are a whole range of activities that will call upon the international neighborhood to respond. But right now, there's an overload, and I see this in the Security Council at the UN. There's what we call donor fatigue. How many nations can put up troops or provide the wherewithal to address all of these many problems? So I think we have to be, and it's a difficult thing to do, but you have to be selective in where the international community can become involved, because if you spread yourself too thinly, you will not accomplish anything. So these are the kinds of issues that we're grappling with right now almost on an everyday basis.
Well, the selectivity does sometimes depend upon whose interests are affected. The Security Council has gone a very long way in some of the precedents it's now set, perhaps furthest, I think, in saying the situation in Haiti is a threat to international peace and security, the only grounds on which the UN Security Council can intervene. But a threat to international peace and security is essentially what the Security Council says it is. I don't think the refugee flow from Haiti would have led the Security Council to call it a threat to international peace and security if it had been off the coast of Africa. But when refugees can get to Florida and thereby touch the interests of one of the most powerful countries in the Security Council, it's dubbed the threat to international peace and security. I think we need to look beyond that language and see when it is justified to intervene on grounds of internal democracy and human rights, which may or may not pose a threat across borders to international peace and security.
Francis Tang.
Well, you know, excuse me. In a way, one could even argue that there is a degree to which this notion, this yardstick of threat to international security is becoming a fiction. Because if people decide that something must be done, as the United States decided with respect to Somalia, it is easy to then use that as a justification, whereas what really drove the country into it was something else, was the compelling conditions of innocent civilians in that part of the world. On the other hand, maybe it would help if the world were to determine certain criteria in advance to say that this is what sovereignty entails, responsibility for the citizens, and that if there should be a violation to a certain degree, there ought to be a trigger effect from the international community. Now, the problem with that, of course, is it has to be credible, in the sense that if there is that violation, it should be expected that the international community would move. I understand perfectly why one has to be selective, as Ian said, and also Rick. But I also think that the question that must be posed is it ultimately acceptable, conscionable, tolerable for the international community to see the type of massacring that's going on now in Rwanda and do nothing? Is it ultimately in the interest of the international community that we have a global peace in the genuine sense? Or will what happens in a seemingly remote area eventually reach us in one way or another and be a matter of our common concern?
Ian Martin, you want to
respond? Yeah, I agree with that, and I think it's very ironic that the international community, the UN, particularly the US position, was hardening towards intervention at the precise moment when the very case where intervention was most morally compelling and indeed feasible in terms of saving tens of thousands of lives, Rwanda, came along, and as a result, the reaction of the international community has been extremely, extremely slow. I mean, yes, selectivity, but on any basis of selectivity, Rwanda was a situation at the very top of the list to compel international intervention.
Let me just add on that, or contribute to that. Extremely slow, but in a very chaotic situation. And the world community has responded to Rwanda through a great amount of humanitarian assistance to all of the populations there that have moved to the border areas and have moved toward Tanzania and towards Burundi. And there has been an outpouring of humanitarian assistance. What we're talking about here is the question of a peacekeeping intervention. And in that case, you did have member states that were already part of the so-called UNAMIR contingent that notified the UN that they were leaving. They simply were pulling up stakes and getting out because they thought the situation was too dangerous for their own national contingents. They had gone under UN auspices for one mandate, and the situation obviously changed very quickly and very tragically. And so the UN has now been trying to play catch-up on exactly how to proceed there. And there have been differences about the way to mount the most effective operation. The UN is not in a position to have many more failures. This is an overworked system right now, and there has to be some attempt, even when we face the kind of catastrophe that we've seen, there has to be some attempt to make whatever the UN does effective and directed toward the what it is able to accomplish. So Rwanda has been, it's been another terrible lesson in sort of the post-Cold War peacekeeping, but it's something that I think that we can obviously draw some important lessons upon.
You're listening to Common Ground. It's a service of the Stanley Foundation. My guests are Rick Interfer, the representative for Special Political Affairs at the U.S. Mission to the United Nations, Ian Martin, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former Secretary General of Amnesty International, and Francis Deng of the Brookings Institution, formerly of the Sudanese Foreign Service. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details. When a conflict erupts within a sovereign country, Francis Deng would like the international community to respond to more than just the immediate humanitarian crisis.
You know, there's a question, in a sense, really, about this humanitarian response. And I don't want to be understood as being critical of it, because it's a necessity, it's basic, it's something that ought to be very much appreciated when the international community responds the way it does on a humanitarian basis. But there is a problem with it. One is that we may take humanitarian response as a substitute to addressing the real problem. Because as long as the real problem is not addressed, the humanitarian needs will just continue to increase. Secondly, it seems to me that humanitarian response can also undermine many other things. For instance, in countries like the Sudan, where the war lingers on, and the international community is responding generously on the humanitarian basis, providing what is possibly easy to provide, food and other things, but not addressing the root causes. You have a people who for maybe decades begin to depend on international support, humanitarian support. And it undermines their own ability to be resourceful and self-reliant, which they cannot be as long as the conflict continues. Whereas if the issue were addressed at the root causes, they would be in a position to sustain their own life and may not need that degree of dependency, which will be growing over the years.
And how could the international community address those root causes?
Well, again, as we were saying, there are, I suppose, international standards, whether we are talking of human rights or the conduct of states or the responsibilities of sovereignty. And if a country does not live up to that, and we see the evidence or the consequences of that failure resulting in masses of people dying, suffering, starving, it seems to me that there ought to be a way in which the international community should respond. Now, the range of response can, I suppose, expand from diplomatic initiatives on the one end and ultimately to some sort of international action. And it seems to me if the criteria are determined in advance so that governments will know that by failing to meet a minimum standard, there will be international reaction, I think that could be a preventive measure. I think governments would impose on themselves a lot more. When, on the other hand, governments see that the international community would fail, even under conditions like that of Rwanda, and of course we know what happened in Somalia, maybe some governments would begin to feel that they're quite safe and that international will to intervene is at the minimum.
I very much agree with the emphasis on not only dealing with current crises, they must be dealt with, but anticipating crises and trying to act to prevent them and address their root causes.
This is Ian Martin of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
That means an enormously strengthened United Nations system, and it means a lot more resources for the United Nations. At the moment, what the United Nations spends on preventing conflicts is trivial compared with what it spends on peacekeeping, and what member states spend on peacekeeping through the United Nations is absolutely trivial compared with their defense budgets. So we really need to reorder some of those priorities and ensure that resources do go into the international community trying to anticipate and address the causes of crises rather than spend their resources on dealing with them when they occur.
Now I want to finish our conversation with a bit of discussion really about why we're here, and that's the effect these conflicts have on the people within a country. And Francis, you've written quite extensively about the displacement of people within their own countries, and one of the things I got from your writing was that the numbers of people that we're seeing displaced today within their own country are even greater than refugees, about whom we hear a lot more, who may cross the international border. What kind of numbers are we looking at with these people who are displaced from their homes right within their own country?
The estimates about 3 years ago when this mechanism was established, a representative of Secretary General for Internally Displaced Persons, was that we had 17 million refugees and 24 million displaced persons inside their own countries. Recently, the High Commissioner for Refugees gave an estimate of 20 million refugees. And we understand that those who are internally displaced range from 25 to 30 million. And mind you, the numbers continue to increase as we hear news of conflicts around the world. What is problematic about this group, though, is because they are within their countries, they are sort of within the sovereignty of the countries, and therefore the role of the international community is limited by that fact. The appointment of a representative of the Secretary General was very controversial. And right now, in sort of operating, I'm very sensitive to respecting the governments, to going into a country, assuring them of my respect for their sovereignty, but also arguing that responsibility goes with sovereignty, and that most governments want to discharge that, and sometimes have the problems of capacity. Occasionally, some governments lack the will. And if that is the case, and the consequences are severe on the population, then they should expect the international community to be concerned.
And are these people who are displaced within their own country in more danger than, say, an international refugee? Because there isn't much of a system in place to assist them, is there?
Well, you see, refugees are people who flee conditions of persecution, conflict, gross violations of human rights, and all that. By stepping outside their borders, they're immediately protected. Those who are within their own countries are usually displaced by the same factors, you know, internal conflict, gross violations of human rights, occasionally natural disasters. And the degree to which they are protected is affected by what I call the vacuum of moral responsibility, in that in these conflicts, very often governments are parties to the conflict. And they are divided by maybe ethnicity, religion, race, what have you. So they are not identified as part of the system. The government sees them as the others, as part of the enemy, maybe as part of the rebel group. Therefore, there is no authority within the country that has that degree of care which, for instance, international organizations have for the refugees.
One last question, Rick Interfirth, and that is, Have we witnessed the end of the era of sovereignty?
I don't think we have witnessed the end of the era of sovereignty, but I think what you do obtain from this discussion is a very clear evidence that we are all moving into new areas, whether they be displaced persons, human rights. We haven't talked about, for instance, the creation of the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, how to deal with that, how we're trying to look at peacekeeping to make it a more effective instrument for the international community, and how the definition of international peace and security is expanding. So what we're seeing here in all of these areas is a broader acceptance by the international community of its responsibilities in the areas that it must address. And I think that that's what we're going through, sometimes fitfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. But that has been the major, in my view, the major result of the end of the Cold War, that we're moving into these new areas and we're recognizing that we have more common responsibilities than we were able to attend to before.
Ian Martin, a final thought?
A long time ago, the world moved away from sovereignty being divinely vested in kings or emperors. I mean, sovereignty derives from people. And when governments have ceased on a massive scale to respect the rights of their people and serve their interests, then the international community has to be prepared to address those problems itself.
And Francis Tang, I'll give you the last word.
Well, the last word is the role of leadership. I think that the international community has always looked to leadership, whether it was during the colonial era or during the Cold War era, and now after the post-Cold War. And it seems to me, after the Cold War, it seems to me that on this issue of leadership, there is no question as to who the leader is. The question is whether that leader will live up to that challenge beyond national interest, and I'm thinking of the United States.
Francis Tang of the Brookings Institution has been one of our guests on Common Ground. He was a member of the Sudanese Foreign Service and Sudan's Minister for Foreign Affairs from 1976 to 1980. We also heard from Ian Martin, the former Secretary General of Amnesty International and head of the 1993 UN OAS Civilian Mission in Haiti, and Rick Interfer, the representative for Special Political Affairs at the United States Mission to the United Nations. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Order a printed transcript or audio cassette of this Common Ground program, contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-825-5746. Ask for program number 9429. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. The zip code is 52761. Again, to purchase transcripts or audio cassettes, contact Journal Graphics at 1-800-825-5746, and the program number is 9429. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.